Hey folks, thank you for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. In addition to the new Cafe Insider podcast, we're sharing bonus material from my interviews on Stay Tuned with Preet. This is exclusively for you. Hope you enjoy it. So we all know how much the president cares about immigration in a way that I think is detrimental to the country and to how we're viewed in the world. I made no secret of that. Even though he's got a high-level aide by the name of Stephen Miller, who I have a lot of problems with, and I think doesn't understand the values that make this country strong when it comes to being welcoming to people from outside the country, like my family was. There has been all this talk of the president wanting to appoint a sort of immigration czar. Now, czar is an interesting term. It derives from the ancient Roman imperial title, Caesar, and it basically means supreme ruler. But in the modern era in America, there have been all sorts of people who have been given the informal title czar. Franklin Roosevelt had a czar of production. There was an energy czar. One of our former highly esteemed guests, Ron Klain, was appointed the Ebola czar in recent years. But unlike the way the term was understood in ancient Roman times, a czar in the American government does not have a militia, does not have armies to command, is not in any way, shape, or form supreme ruler. One of the reasons I'm mentioning it is there was some reporting a few days ago that the president was maybe going to tap a guy by the name of Kris Kobach. Kris Kobach, by the way, is a classmate of mine from Harvard, but more significantly, was the former Secretary of State in Kansas and also ran this sort of ill-advised and short-lived panel on voter fraud that has since been disbanded. And the reason I mention it is it appears that Kris Kobach, in anticipation of maybe becoming the quote-unquote immigration czar, did have aspirations to be a kind of Caesarian supreme ruler figure because, as we have learned in the news, he made specific demands of what he would require to accept this position of czar, including among them an office in the West Wing, walk-in privileges with the president. I guess that means he doesn't have to knock. The highest pay level for White House senior staff. This is one of my favorites. 24/7 access to either a DHS or DOD jet. Czar must be on the border every week. That's from the document that was leaked to the press. Czar must be on the border every week. And also, because he's a family man, he needs the jet for his ability to spend weekends in Kansas with family on way from border back to D.C. Unless, according to the document, POTUS needs czar elsewhere. Security detail if deemed necessary. Principal spokesman on television and in the media. And my personal favorite, even more than the jet, is number 10, a promise that by November 1, 2019, the president will nominate Kris Kobach to be DHS secretary unless, because he could be choosy, unless Kobach wishes to continue in czar position. So there you have an interesting and fairly arrogant list of demands that includes everything except green M&Ms, like some rock stars might request backstage at a show. It should maybe come as no surprise that since the time when that list was leaked to the press, it looks like, at the time I'm recording this, that that position of czar will not be going to the very needy Kris Kobach, but instead appears to be going to former Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli. But it leads to an interesting question, whether it's Ken Cuccinelli or anyone else. Why have czars? Why have that title if they actually don't have a lot of power? It is infrequently the case that administrations actually refer to these appointments as czars. It's largely a media term. And I think it maybe has something to do with the American penchant for wanting to see some sort of shining white knight who takes on an issue, whether it's Ebola or energy or Iran or the border or anything else, and through sheer dint of personality and effort and supreme leadership skills, solves the problem. Doesn't always work that way, but maybe that's how we see that position. The so-called czar can be anything that the president wants. Essentially, it's a regular employee who has some charge that's informally given or could be formally given, where they report back but don't have the ability to really enact policy they could perhaps recommend. There's a more formal disconnect between the title and the public expectation and media reaction to the appointment of a czar and what their actual authority is within the government with respect to how they're appointed. You might expect that somebody who has the title czar, even though it's not a cabinet position, would need to be approved in some way by the Senate. But no, the Constitution calls for, in the Appointments Clause, Senate confirmation for certain kinds of officials, including ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for. Those folks in the last clause are known as inferior officers. And if you are, in fact, an inferior officer, you need to be confirmed by the Senate before you can be serving in the position for which you've been appointed. Not so of czars. Czars don't have armies. Czars don't have supreme power. Czars don't have to be confirmed by the Senate. Czars serve at will, and czars tend not to get private jets. But for the record, I will say, people ask me if I will accept some public service job in the future. I'm pretty prepared to say that I will accept any future appointment as czar. In this time of great tumult and focusing on the real world, you have written how many? 71 novels? 72 novels? It's a lot of novels, David.
I've written 11 novels.
I've written one book. Yeah. Where on earth did you find the time to do that? And then second, many people have said to me that they are so consumed by the news and probably reading your columns and listening to you as I do, that they have read fewer novels for pleasure since the election of Donald Trump than they ever had before. What do you make of that, and is that your experience?
Well, I think this is an anxious time. We're spending too much time watching the news. I mean, I often think about watching the news, and I'll think, this is crap. You know, I mean, this is not, it's ephemeral. We're just getting cranked about the latest tweet. I take great pleasure, especially in a period like this, in writing fiction. The novel I just finished a week ago, it'll be published next year.
Congratulations.
It's a novel I'm really proud of. It's a much darker book than probably any that I've written, but it has a character who, you know, embodies things that I hope will really interest readers. Story about somebody who creates an absolute disaster and then tries to figure out why and what led to it, and then to overcome it. And the best thing about it, I don't know if that's a good book or not, but I know that it helped get me out of news addiction and kind of news craziness and, you know, Trump craziness, to be honest. There are better things in the world to worry about.
One thing that I find very appealing about your approach and your demeanor to things, and why I like watching you on television over many, many other people, and including in this conversation on the podcast today, you know, obviously you have deep and strong feelings about America's place in the world, about, you know, what's happening to our alliances, about, you know, what's going to happen in the future, and you feel them strongly and you feel them passionately. And yet when you present your points and your arguments and your theses, you're pretty measured about it and pretty sober about it at a time when lots and lots of people are yelling all the time and screaming all the time. And so my questions are, one, how do you do it? And two, what's your advice to people who are frantically and frenetically upset all the time about how, other than reading your novels, which they all should, how they might take a page from your book and in their conversations with friends and family members and colleagues, adopt a little bit of your tone and approach?
Well, it's a wonderful question to be asked. What I say to myself and what I say to my children, you know, if I'm really struggling with something, is just literally take a walk. Just get up and you know, get away from the screen that you're looking at or the problem that's vexing you. I think it is the most difficult thing in the world to detach ourselves enough to see something with a little bit of perspective. And so, the other thing that we know is if you're the best antidote for any bad thing is to get some exercise. That's what I'm about to do right now, is go play tennis for my team that I play on. And I know I will have more useful comments about foreign policy after this match is over than I do now.
I began this interview admiring you deeply, and now I resent you horribly, because not only do you have the right approach, not only do you sound very smart, not only do you educate, but you also have time to write novels and exercise.
Well,
you're really irritating, David.
I want to be so. The listening to you, I want to be me. I feel like that person. But it's great. I enjoyed this a lot. You and I have talked in the past. I've always tried to get you to say things, and you've been just infuriatingly discreet. And I wish I should have learned your rule.
Thanks again for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. Listen to the Cafe Insider podcast every Monday with me and Ann Milgram, and stay tuned every Thursday.